Everything the Soviets do has a purpose. They do nothing without a motive or a plan. As soon as they attained power, they began a program to destroy our Jewish people. The first thing they did was to begin to close all the yeshivas and Talmud Torahs. They thought that by destroying the religious schools, they would destroy our people. And so they aimed their first attack at the Torah. But there were Jews who would hide in order to learn. They would go into back rooms and cellars to teach their children. I have a friend who is now a rabbi in the United States, who received his first Jewish education in Soviet Russia, sitting by an open window in the back bedroom of his home, holding a rubber ball in his hand. Now, an American boy of 20 years ago, and in some schools even today, was also likely to have in his hand a rubber ball during his Hebrew lesson, if the teacher wasn't watchful. But with my friend, it was at the command of the teacher and under his very watchful eye, and no American boy ever held a rubber ball with such dread lest he have to use it. Where at every knock on the front door, at the approach of any unknown stranger, my friend had to jump through the window into the back courtyard and pretend that he was playing ball. He was playing for his life and the life of his teacher, whom they would have sent to Siberia if they found that he was teaching Torah. The Bolsheviks went so far as to teach Jewish children in their state schools that it was their duty, as good communists, to testify against their parents should they attempt to give them any kind of Jewish education. And many were the parents who, because of this, were locked in prison and sent to Siberia. But two generations have passed since then, and the Soviets saw that the end of the Jewish nation in Russia had not yet come in spite of their closing the schools. For the synagogue remained the spiritual center of the people. It inspired them and kept many of them faithful. The Soviets saw the vast throngs of Jews who came to the synagogues, even once a year, who stood silently, since there were no prayer books, silently weeping and praying. They saw the joy with which the Jews of Russia would greet representatives of the Israeli embassy and any Jew from Israel and the United States. They saw in this joy, love, reverence, yearning, and the prayer for freedom. And so they decided that as long as the synagogue survived, the Jew of Russia would be reminded that he is part of the Jewish people, a limb of the Jewish body, that he would continue to dream of the land of Israel, for his right to practice his faith and to learn his Torah. They saw in this the failure of their plan to destroy the Jewish people by destroying our school. So during the last 6 or 7 years, they began to close the synagogues. At first, when a synagogue would be closed, Jews would obtain a permit, gather in a house, and pray there. But now that, too, is forbidden. There are cities with over 100,000 Jews where not even one synagogue is permitted. Only in Moscow does the great synagogue still stay open, because shutting it would shame the Soviet government before the diplomats of the world had come there. In this way, the Russian government seeks to destroy the last hope of our people, the sanctuary, which was the stronghold of our spirit for almost 3,000 years, the dream of David, the prayer of King Solomon. How the heart of the Jew in Russia must sadden who remembers from the Bible King Solomon's prayer of the dedication of the Holy Temple on Jerusalem, a prayer which has been the creed of the synagogue throughout our history. Every man who prays of all our people Israel, each man knowing the affliction of his own heart, will lift his hands to this house of worship, said King Solomon. With a heavy heart, the Jew of Russia lifts his hands. The doors with signs posted on them closed by order of the Soviet government. My people shall be afflicted by the enemy. They shall pray to you in this house of worship, said King Solomon. And the Jew in Russia must turn away in despair from the house of worship closed to him because of persecution, because of the plan of the enemy. Gone is his refuge, gone his place of prayer, gone his source of inspiration, gone his link with his people in all countries of all time, in Jerusalem, in Israel, with freedom, with salvation, gone his meeting place, his rejoicing hall, his haven of comfort.
gone his hope, his life, is the life of his existence. There must still be prayer today. There must still be prayer today somewhere in the Soviet Union. But under what conditions and what hidden cellars, with what muffled tones, and dread of discovery and accusation, and God alone, in whose holy name they risk their lives only now. Our history has known such gatherings of secret prayer. We did it under Titus and Tinius Rufus and Hadrian, and the barbaric Visigoths and Torquemada of the Spanish Inquisition, and under the Nazis. A survivor of the Nazi death camps tells of such a gathering. They were forced to work in the death brigade. It was their job to unearth the corpses from the mass graves after they had been murdered, search them for valuables, and then carry them to the crematoria where the traces of the horror would be erased by fire. He writes as follows. 9th October, 1943. The mountain of 2,000 corpses we unearthed yesterday is already burning. The days in Kippur and many of us are fasting. Yesterday, Erev in Kippur and the Death Brigade, you could feel that the whole day was approaching. When we had returned from our hideous labor, almost all of us quickly washed and even changed. A few minutes later, we began all together from our barracks to softly and fervently say, Kol Nidre. Davening in a congregation was a terribly dangerous thing to do. The Nazi would have us all shot on the spot if they discovered us. So we had a small number of those who were not religious stand outside and warn us that they were coming. We could only prevail on a small number to stand on watch, because most of those who had never been religious insisted on praying with us and fasting the whole Yom Kippur too. And that was no easy thing to do in our circumstances. We had to work as hard on that day as any other day. Our bodies had been terribly weakened, and the smell and the smoke of the burning dead made us thirsty and sick. A group of us who were religious held to our practices in spite of any difficulties that came our way. It was forbidden to take into the concentration camps even a scrap of paper from the outside. If they found anything in a man's possession, he would be shot on the spot. If we paid no attention to this, for if we found a sitter in the pockets of a victim, we would smuggle it into the barracks. This was much more dangerous than smuggling money or gold which could be hidden, for the sidurim and tefillin would be used every day, the sidurim twice a day, or mincha and mitre too. So in Yom Kippur we had a few sidurim which we could take out and pray with. Amongst those who prayed every day were many who had not been in any way religious before the war. Many of us in the concentration camps experienced a deep and complete spiritual transformation. Who knows, my friends, how many Jews today in the Soviet Union are standing watch before shuttered windows and closed cellar doors and locked rooms from which can be discerned the muted murmur of voices praying in anguish. Who knows the spiritual transformation that has come over many of our people who have been far away from Judaism? Now, fortunate, we here must feel ourselves that we may pray openly, that we have the blessings of the highest official in this blessed land, that messages of goodwill sincerely meant come to us from the president, his advisors, men in government. How lucky, how blessed we are that the Senate was opened just the other day with greetings for the new year. Have we no debt to pay for this? Have we not the duty to think that we were so chosen? Not because we are more worthy than our brothers, but only because we have now a task to do in their behalf and in behalf of Jewry all over the world as well as in our own. What can we do? We can pray, we can go to the United Nations, we can protest, but that isn't enough. Above all, we must here begin to build a Judaism which is strong in spirit and rich in content. Without question, there shall yet come a time when Jews the world over, and including those behind the Iron Curtain, will be redeemed. But from where will they take their leaders? What form will such a Judaism have? Once upon a time, Russia provided our leaders. Every great Jewish institution of higher learning is served by a faculty today of Jewish scholars of Russian training. And so it is in Zionism. Our leaders, our Weizmanns and Ben-Gurions, come from there. And so in every productive area of Jewish life. We are now being nourished from the waters these leaders drew from the well that once was. But now, as we plead with God that they should be redeemed, we begin to imagine what has happened to that well of learning, leadership, and inspiration. We can imagine what kind of Torahless, spiritless community there has remained from all the greatness that once was. We must make up for this loss by what we do here. Let the Soviet government see that though they can hurt Judaism for a moment, though they can choke it off in one place, it shall revive here in this country. And like a strong tree whose branches cut in one place send out new shoots, it will blossom again and bring salvation to our people. We shall provide the leadership for the world. We shall build synagogues like ours, which will rebuild the spirit of our people here in this country and all over the world. This synagogue, our Beis Mikdosh Miat, will give us and them hope and healing. Here we will pray. And so we appeal to you to maintain and build this synagogue so that it may flourish, for it is our hope and theirs. The rabbis tell us that Yizkor has no value or meaning without an accompanying act of charity in memory of our loved ones. That is because only in deed of dedication to our people and its life shall our prayers that they be given eternal life be heard and answered. Let this, then, be the beginning of our commitment to the life of our people, so that we help unite all of us, inspire all of our people, and ultimately redeem them, that for young as well as old, this shall be a school of Jewish learning, a gathering place of joy, a comfort and sadness, a well of faith, a mother beckoning to her children, seeking warmth, beauty, love, teaching, and shelter. Let us be worthy to produce leaders for our people's future, who shall help rebuild shattered communities, revive the spirit of our people crushed under oppression. In the concentration camps, a great sage and scholar and writer, Baruch Katz Nelson, was taken to his death. He hid a poem that he had written, with which I would like to conclude my words this day. A poem that he had written to American Jewry as he and his family were being taken to be shot and then to the crematoria. This is what he says. We are lost. In a few hours we will be in the next world. I hide in this in the hope that someone find it. It is my last will and testament. A testament I cannot leave to my children, my family, or my friends, for we are all going soon to our death. We leave no inheritors of our banner, our pride, and our hope. You, our brothers and sisters whom God has given the fortune to be in a free America, be our inheritors. Carry on the holiness that was ours. That which is destroyed and wasted here, build there, strong, mightier, prouder. Be a path